I'd like to talk about today about the church in resistance, the church and its role of resisting apartheid. And the title that was put up was Resistance, the Church in Resistance in South Africa, or the Confessing. And that's related to, and I want to begin by not talking about South Africa, but recalling to your minds, no, that's not where I want to start. I forgot I want to say something else first. Scratch that. I wanted to start off, first of all, with an introductory word saying that I'd like to get you in a little unsafe territory today. I wanted to remind you and remind myself that talking about struggles for justice in South Africa is very safe. And it's easy. Those of you who were also here last week remember that our conversations were more about justice in America, and they were a little bit more emotionally received. It's safe for us to talk about the evil in South Africa. Important. I don't want to say it's not important, because South African people need all the help they can get in resisting that evil system they suffer under. Important also because what the United States does in relationship to South Africa will be incredibly important. Right now, the United States is on the wrong side. And if we don't change sides, we will be more responsible than anybody else for the blood that's going to flow in the next 10 years in South Africa. Because our government, our investment, our corporations, our banks, our money is supporting and keeping alive the white apartheid government of South Africa. So it's important.
Are there no legislatures that people in the Congress that all that go contrary to that?
Yes, there are, but they're not in the majority.
Who are, name some of them.
Well, I'm going to stutter when I do this because I am not, my work is not in legislative campaigns, and that's why I put up the resource of Ted Lockwood and the Washington Office on Africa. But Ted Kennedy, I haven't thought about this for about a month and I've forgotten names. Who's the guy from Iowa?
Clark.
And the whole committee. Committees that are related to the protection of corporate investments around the world. Committees, especially that are related to the Export-Import Bank, and and committees, and the foreign. Oh gosh, I'm not thinking about that. What's foreign policy committee?
Foreign Affairs Committee
just recently managed to get through both the House and the Senate. Stipulations that make it look like it's going to be possible soon for all of the restrictions against trade with Rhodesia to be taken away. So there's a lot of action in the Congress that's taking place. But at this point, in terms of changing our governmental policy of protecting corporate investments in South Africa, has not been turned around, and does not look like it's going to be turned around in the near future. I am not an expert in legislative matters, so that's about all. About as far as I'm going to go in answering your questions about that. If anybody has other information, I'd be glad to share more with it. Matter of fact, John Schramm probably knows, I'm sure does, out of his base in Washington, there's a lot more information about that than I do, in general at least. But what I wanted to say about that is that in the sense of even changing our pressure to change our policies in South Africa is also a safe issue, relatively speaking. It's a little less safe when we realize that we are helping to keep that government alive, and it becomes a little less safe. I want to just turn the question around for our thinking about it and beginning to struggle with the issue that South Africa, it's not just simply that we are helping to keep South Africa alive, but that kind of a government in South Africa and many, many other places around the world keeps us alive, keeps us in our position of privilege, makes it possible. We live, and it's not a matter of sort of left-wing speculation anymore. It's generally agreed upon that the many, many kind of relationships that we have within the world and in our economic and political systems, that it's more and more being realized that the way we are consuming the world and the systems that allow us to consume and overconsume the world mean that the continued poverty of the rest of the world will not change so long as we don't change. And that therefore the poverty of the rest of the world ends up being a requirement for our richness. That all of the theories about the development of the world through the trickle-down theories benefiting from the flourishing of our cultures are not working. And the third world, as well as the second world, that is the first world being the capitalist countries of the United States and Europe and a few others like Japan, the second world being the communist world, and the third world being the poverty world of Latin America, Africa, and Asia, the second world and the third world are, when they talk about liberation, they're talking about being liberated from systems that require poverty in order that other people might be rich. Extremely important for Christians to be struggling with those issues. Extremely important to realize, as painful as it is to us to deal with them, that Christian brothers and sisters around the world who are not white and Western, but third world Christians who are coming into their own, used to be objects of our mission, and now are independent churches identifying with their own people's needs and their own people's need for justice. People from around the world are preaching the gospel to us and asking us to re-examine our understanding of the relationship of our faith to our economic system and to justice. I don't want to say more about that now. We can talk more about it. We want to talk more about South Africa, but I'd like us, when we think about justice in South Africa and our support for it, to not think of it just in safe ways. How can we help those evil people change? But to know that it ain't that simple, and that change in South Africa inevitably means change for us. Now, tomorrow, I want to talk more about that. And I want to talk today about the church and resistance, but both of these subjects come under that kind of a rubric, that kind of an understanding that we're not just talking about changing South Africa, but the change in South Africa requires us to look at ourselves. And so today when I talk about church and resistance, I'm going to talk the first half about the church and resisting apartheid in South Africa, but then I want to come back home and talk about the church here and resisting apartheid here. When I use the term resistance, and I'd like to think of you as the word resistance with some quotes around it, I want to use it in a special way. A way that's very, very important to the Christian tradition. And I can recall some things to memory for you that many of us have lived through, that many of you have lived through, and it comes especially out of our own histories in World War II and the Confessing Church in Germany in its resistance, in its underground resistance as a church, as the Confessing Church to the Hitler regime. Now, resistance also meant a much broader kind of thing. It meant the resistance in terms of the guerrilla movements and the resistance in Norway and Sweden and France in terms of resisting the oncoming of the Nazi troops. Within the church, it also had special meaning. It had the special meaning of the Christian faith and as how it would participate in that, and also how it also included the resistance against the rest of the church. Because the confessing church was a small minority, and its resistance was not only in relationship to the Nazi regime, but also a resistance in terms of the conflict between the confessing church and the rest of the church. I forgot a Bible. Did somebody hand me a Bible? Oh, thank you. Already let me jump back in history for a second and not talk about Germany and the confessing church, but already in the very, very early part of the church, the term resistance became important, not just in a general way to resist evil, as I'm going to read from you in Paul's letter to the Ephesians, but it also had some very important kind of applications, and especially, and I want to come to some very special issues of resistance, when it became a symbol for Christians to refuse to put the pinch of incense on the emperor's altar, and therefore to rebel against government as an act of faith. The pinch of incense recognized the authority of the emperor in matters of government and religion, and made the government the religious authority. And so from the very beginning, very, very early in the church, the Christian church raised up special issues of resistance, that if you were a Christian, it was not a matter of debate any longer whether you would believe this or do this, but participating in this act of resistance became part of your definition of what it means to be a Christian. St. Paul, if I can find it quickly, I've forgotten the chapter. At the end of Ephesians, after having placed these words in a context of the final victory of Christ and of the unity of the church and the call of the people of God who have been set free by the victory of Christ to be God's people in the world, says, and this is a kind of word about resistance, says, "Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might, put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand the wiles of the devil." And remember, for Paul, didn't just leave the devil out there in a red underwear and horns, but talked to the principalities and powers that are visible and invisible, and included for the early church the powers that said, the pinch of incense will save your life, but it will also deny your faith. "For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Wherefore, take unto you the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand," which is translated in modern version, "resist in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. Stand, therefore, having your loins girded with truth, and having the breastplate of righteousness," and so forth, describing the Christian's armor in terms of resistance to the evil of this world and of the universe. That is to say that for Christians throughout history, there have been certain times and certain issues raised up that to resist and take a stand upon against them was not a matter of choice, but a matter of the confession of the faith, and to not identify with those issues of resistance was to deny the faith. Now there's a term for that. There's a Latin term that the church has used for centuries, and it's called raising an issue to a matter of status confessionis. You don't have to know the term, except it's been used very recently in relationship to South Africa, and that's what I'm leading up to tell you about. To raise up the putting of a pinch of incense on the emperor's altar, to not do that, to resist doing that, to resist the emperor's demand to do that, became a matter of status confessionis. You could say, "I believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and in Jesus Christ, his only Son, our Lord," and somewhere, and in not putting a pinch of incense on the altar, is raising that issue up to a matter of confession of faith. Most of the things we talk about in terms of justice, you can say, "You disagree with her, and you disagree with me, and I disagree with you," and act differently, come back to the communion table and say, in Christ, we need to pray and struggle about that. But when a matter is raised up to a matter of status confessionis, then the church has said, there's no disagreement about that anymore. It's a matter of confession of faith. So it's you do that with fear and trembling. You don't do that with many issues, because by doing that, you only contribute to the division of the church. Resistance to the Third Reich in Germany became a matter of status confessionis. Last June, in Dar es Salaam, when the Lutheran World Federation met for its World Assembly, it does every 6 years, is it, I think? Six, seven, something years. At the request of the delegation from South Africa, resistance to apartheid was declared a matter of status confessionis. The implications of that are just beginning to be spelled out. It was a very emotional time when it happened. It's not done lightly. It's never done lightly. It's only a few times in history that such a thing has been done. It was done by the request of the delegation, which was black and white. Although it must be said that the white delegates did not represent the full voice of their church. That is, that they were, their opinions were are not generally agreed upon in South Africa. But at the request of the delegation from South Africa and Namibia, a black and white delegation, the resolution was brought before the Lutheran World Federation and its assembly, and I have the exact words for this, which I suppose I ought to read you if I'm going to, should have pulled these out ahead of time. I may not be able to do it quickly. I'll talk while I'm doing it. There was a lot of debate. There was a lot of changing of the words. There was a lot of people afraid that if this would do this, it was going to be a divisive thing in the church, because it was obvious that a lot of people would not go along with it. But when they ended up the convention, they I'm sorry, I thought I had it right here. If I find it, I'll get it to you. They came out with a resolution which declared the opposition to apartheid as a matter of status confessionis.
Would they actually take a vote and have a majority, or would it have to be 100%?
I believe that the final vote, I was not there for the entire conference, and so I wasn't in for all of the debates on it, but I was there for the final vote, and I believe it had one vote in opposition and two votes in abstention, or something to that effect.
This is the Lutheran Church,
and I'm sorry, I'm such a disorganized slob. I promise to if I find it and read it to you tomorrow.
Why hasn't this been publicized?
Well, it has. It was reported on in the Lutheran magazines in the news sections. It was headlined in all of the reports on the Lutheran World Federation Assembly that were published by the church. So it hasn't been kept quiet. So I think sometimes actions that the church does take are kept quiet because they will be upsetting. I really do believe that. But I don't think that happened in this case. I think that it was reported regularly. The reason it's quieter is for two reasons. One is that it's, at least in its initial application, is for over there, and it hasn't been kept quiet there. And the second thing is that the implications of it are still to be worked out. It's not the kind of thing you say, therefore, 1, 2, 3, and 4, but rather you live out and begin to discover the implications of it, to discover whether or not some of the white churches of South Africa now will drop out of the Lutheran World Federation because of this. That's a year or two's decision-making process on their part. The implications of it in terms of resistance are extremely important.
What happens from actions that they vote on in the Lutheran Federation? Now, is that something that, I don't know how that works, is that passed on to like local churches just as a stance, or is it an action?
No, it's passed on as information. It is not something that binds any individual national church. So that's why a national white church in South Africa, and I think there are 7 individual white Lutheran denominations in South Africa, have to vote on whether or not they accept that. And when they do that, the enforcement of that, of course, is obviously if they vote against it, then they have to choose not to be a member of the Lutheran World Federation. So the enforcement of that is very, very weak. Its importance in terms of what it means to us and what it is to be Christian is very important.
Well, so would you say we're working about is it part of a creed now? Is it part of a liturgy?
No. I imagine also, my imagination says that within the next couple of years it will be liturgized. But no, they don't change the creed. It's just simply, it is a declaration that this church believes, that the Lutheran World Federation believes, and it's for the national churches to implement, that it declares in assembly that the opposition to apartheid is a matter of status confessionis. I'll find it and read it to you, but I've almost said it all. There's two other sentences, I think.
Does this mean, for instance, that in the national conventions of the synods in this country, this declaration from the World Federation might come up for affirmation, or?
It will not come up. I do not think it will come up naturally, because it's an application. There is only one system of apartheid, and that's in Southern Africa, in terms of legalizing racial separation, and a system built upon that. And I would like to see it, and I'll come to that in a few moments. I would like to see it for certain reasons also brought up before us, because I think it becomes. At least in some levels, maybe not on the level of voting on it in convention, but we need to really struggle with the implications of what that means for us. And I think that when it was passed, its implications were only thought of as its affecting of Southern Africa.
The delegations to this convention were selected from the various churches? Or
from every national Lutheran church throughout the world.
And they had the option to attend or not to attend? What I'm getting at, how many of the white Lutheran churches within South Africa and Namibia actually attended?
I don't know the means by which delegates are chosen in South Africa. I know that there were delegates from all or most. It's at the Lutheran World Federation, each one of the major bodies in the United States, of the major bodies that belong to the Lutheran World Federation, Missouri Synod doesn't, sent delegates. Elected delegates. They were elected by our national churches. The same process happened in South Africa. I don't know what the process was. It included some representation from most of the white churches and from most of the black churches. There is two organizations of unity in the black churches. The four major black churches are now one church called ELCSA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Southern Africa. There is a federation called FELCSA, Federation of Lutheran Evangelical Lutheran Churches in Southern Africa, to which all the churches belong, white and black, but it doesn't bind them very closely. and they're just beginning to do that. When that was
Why does Missouri choose to abstain from that?
Pardon?
Why does the Missouri Synod choose to abstain from belonging to the World Federation?
Why does it?
Yeah.
Oh, I know some of the reasons. I think that's a long, long subject. I'd be glad to talk about that. I think that's it's part of the whole basis of Missouri Synod's existence, of not being in sacramental communion, word and sacrament communion, with the rest of the Lutheran churches.
Could you give another example besides the Third Reich and apartheid?
Well, I did. The one was the pinch of incense in the early church.
Any more recent ones?
Pardon?
Any more recent ones?
No, I don't think it's been,
so
as far as I know,
seldom.
It's very, very seldom. It's done very, very lightly. And it may not have ever been done before in the history of the Lutheran Church in that kind of a formal way. I don't think in the Third Reich they formally voted at a convention. It became the consensus of the confessional church, the confessing church. It's not something that generally you vote on, but it's something that comes out of the struggle of resistance. And it doesn't say there's nothing else to resist. To resist evil, St. Paul says, all of this armor, and it comes out in principalities and powers unseen and seen. But there are times when the church has to agree on identifying a particular one. If you want to see the devil, there it is, at work. And there can be no more debate on it. So therefore, the reason I've raised this issue is for two reasons. One, to say that for the South African churches now, for the Lutheran churches at least, and I suppose it's going to have a lot of effect on the rest of the churches also, just that decision, the relationship for taking stands against apartheid is now totally different. It used to be that it was a matter of, where do you get the votes? Where do you collect the power to make a decision whether or not we will resist this particular aspect of apartheid or this one, and how do you, each time you come to it, you have to say, should we resist or shouldn't we resist this? And now provides a firm base for Christians to make decisions about resisting apartheid and that system in South Africa, for Lutherans to do that. Let me give a couple of examples, because it also means that a person, well, I already said that, I'm sorry. Let me just give a couple of examples. In opposing the government, in opposing the apartheid system, the churches in South Africa are in the process of making at least three decisions. I'll give three examples. And for the Lutherans, now having this, it will have a whole basis for deciding that, because they've already agreed upon what resistance means. The government is passing, or has just passed, I haven't read the recent news, it was almost at the edge of passing the last I heard, three new laws called the welfare laws, which are primarily aimed at controlling resistance to apartheid, and focused on, among other groups, especially the church. And they require, among other things, that the church register with the government as an agency of the government for any act of social concern, for any act of social services, so that nobody except those who are registered agents of the government may do acts of charity. For anything outside of the normal life of a congregation, in terms of preaching and receiving the sacrament, the church must register with the government. Prior to this, it could be perhaps a matter of debate. Do we go along with it? Do we register with the government? Or don't we? In terms of the ultimate goal of getting our social services done. It's the way the issue now seems to be going, and I can't say any more about it than this, because it's the thing that they're struggling with right now, is that status confessionis would say, you cannot register with the government. You must resist.
Sounds a little like Russia.
Pardon?
Sounds a little like Russia.
Yeah, oh, it's worse than Russia ever was. Churches in America register with the government for a lot of things and are required for certain things. In New York, I must register with the government in order to be an agent of marrying. And we do that because that has not become a matter of status confessionis. There are people who believe in New York City and in the rest of the country that we shouldn't do that, that we should refuse to do that. But that's still an issue of we can disagree about that and vote on it. Status confessionis in relationship to the system of apartheid says that there's no argument about that.
What's the penalty in South Africa if they don't
break? Nobody knows what penalties are for violating any laws in South Africa. They decide that when you violate them.
Or even if you don't.
Pardon?
Or even if you don't.
Yes. Yeah, right. There's lots of penalties even if you don't oppose them.
Well, have they found anyone who hasn't, and what's happened?
No, the laws are now just in the process of being enacted and enforced, and I think they'll be given some time, 6 months or a year, to register. So we're living through the midst of that history right now. It's the kind of struggles that are taking place right now, and struggles that have incredible importance for us. Their refusing to register with the government for us will have important theological implications for future studies, whether we should register with the government, be required to register with the government to marry somebody, or supply chaplains. The government requires chaplains in South Africa, and now the Lutheran Church is going to have to rethink that whole thing and probably refuse to provide chaplains for the military service. Let me give a second illustration. One of the issues of petty apartheid, I described that the other day, as opposed to the major movements of black people and control of black people, their economics and housing and so forth, is what really keeps apartheid going. But they have also laws of what's called petty apartheid, like we did until 1965 in many places in the United States. White toilets, white buses, black buses, white restaurants, black restaurants. In South Africa, they don't have white restaurants and black restaurants, they have white restaurants. There are no black restaurants. If you work in town, you have to carry your lunch because there's no place you can eat. One of the laws has always been if it were ever enforced, and sometimes it's enforced, sometimes isn't, that you couldn't have white people and black people in church. Now, the churches have been subtly violating that for years, for at least 7 to 10 years. And that's not many places because they're so far apart, so that the white people and black people are so far apart. But like St. Mary's Cathedral of the Anglican Church, half that congregation every Sunday is black, in opposition to the law. About 3 months ago, South Africa passed a law permitting black people to go to churches in white churches. At first glance, that sounds good. But if the church now recognizes the government's right to say they can, that's also admitting they would have the right to say they can't. Status confessionis requires, and it's happening now, that the Lutherans at least, and I think others are doing it with, I'm sure others are doing it with them, publicly make statements that they will not obey that law. Black people are permitted in our churches, but it has nothing to do with that law. A third illustration. No, I'm going to treat that separately. It's the illustration of the church and violence, and I don't want to take that now. I think that's enough now. The issue is Romans 13. Some of you know that St. Paul, one place in his letter to the Romans, really laid down what seems to be laying down the law about obeying the emperor. And it's been an issue of Christian churches throughout the centuries, what that means. And the more the churches ever since the 4th century, the more the churches get bound together with government, and it certainly affects us in our life in the United States, the more it becomes an assumption by everybody that, of course, you have to obey the government. So in the 60s, civil disobedience by Christians seemed a very strange thing, and many people said it's very unchristian. In fact, it has a long, long history in the church, but what hangs everybody up is Romans 13, and I don't want to get into that very deeply today. I only want to say that Status Confessionis says, in this relationship at least, you not only do not have to obey the government, but to obey the government in matters of apartheid is contrary to your faith. Okay, that's a couple of illustrations about government. Let me also say that that's also just raises all kinds of hell inside the church. As it did, for example, as a great biggest example in the Confessing Church in Germany, which was such a small minority, became the underground church. That is, in the white churches, in the black churches, there's no problem, generally speaking, with Status Confessionis. It's a help to them. In the white churches, it goes against the popular opinion. Although many, many people on the issue in the leadership of the church know it's right, it's going to cause great divisiveness in the church. So that they are now going to be facing in the next year or two the issue about how you resist apartheid inside the church. And know that it's going to take an axe and sever the communion rail about people being able to talk to each other, relate to each other. It's going to divide people.
What percent of the whites belong to churches in South Africa? What's your guess?
Oh, I would guess 80%. Very high, very high. It's an extremely religious nation. Within the Lutheran churches, within the white Lutheran churches, and then all of them come out of the same thing as here, out of immigrations, and so they're different parts of Germany and Holland and other parts. Those Lutheran churches are faced with terrible internal problems. A cynical side of me could say they asked for it. but we also all have to understand, and it's incredible the way the black people understand the struggle that white people have to go through and their imprisonment in racism. They're going to have to go through a terrible struggle that will be divisive and painful about the meaning, not only about how they're going to come out in the next 10 years with the political struggle for liberation, but now also internally what that means in terms of their Christian faith.
Joe, do you think there's the remotest possibility that perhaps the end could have been met more effectively by not raising the apartheid situation to the level of status confessione?
Personally, no. I think it was inevitable. I think it's to be celebrated. It gives people who are ready to really struggle in the name of Christ for justice the kind of base that they've been needing for a long time.
Even in view of the extreme divisiveness.
Yes.
That it will.
Yes. Maybe I'm emphasizing the divisiveness too much, because I want us to struggle with the issue. Let me also emphasize as much as I can the strong new base that gives for defining the nature of the Christian faith and liberation in South Africa. Thank you for asking that question, because I didn't emphasize that enough. The basis for making it clear about where the risen Christ is and where the church as the suffering body of Christ must be in its stance and its willingness to stand against evil. Especially a basis for which I think black people implicitly understood Stoutz's Confessiones. White people, the small minority of white people who courageously joined black people in that struggle, have needed this base for a long time.
Joe, you had mentioned about the registration of the churches with the government. Before we think that something like that is going on over there, the same sort of thing's happening here, and it's being fought by Lutheran World Federation, LCA, the ALC, the Missouri Synod's been on it, all the national churches, the same. The American government wants the churches to register their lobby groups and open up their books to government here, and it's being fought by all your major denominations, and that bill is before Congress. I don't think it's been acted on yet, but it's coming up.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an extremely important issue, and I'm glad you said that. The other side of that is that when we refuse to do that, or raise the issue of refusing to do that, we're also raising the obvious other side of that, is to not do that is to give up our privilege. We get an awful lot of privileges as Christians and as institutional Christian churches in this government. And to resist that relationship to government will also challenge and threaten our privilege. And that's, I think it's important we face that.
I was interested, you said that the blacks understand the issues that the whites are going to have to go through. Do you see a possibility that, supposing this bloody revolution does come, do you see the possibility that the blacks and the whites can live together afterwards, once it all gets...
I don't want to underestimate the anger of black people in South Africa or in our country. I don't want to underestimate the fact, psychologically and humanly, that long years of oppression has made, and the longer it goes on and the more oppression that takes place, the more difficult it will be for blacks and whites to live together anywhere in the world, especially South Africa, including here. But I do want to emphasize the other side, and that is that it is incredibly different for us white people to understand, to believe, that black people would want to live with us after what all we've done to them. And it is the flip side of that is that I have found, generally speaking, in my much greater experience in the United States, so I have to speak from that, but also with my brief experience and intense studies in South Africa, the desire of black people not to live in a relationship which now they are in top and we can be on the bottom, not to have a government which drives out white people, not to take revenge, but rather a government of justice. I, over and over again, all of the proposals from the finest of South African people, emphasize that a government that is non-racially based, that of not wanting to drive the white people into the sea, of the most famous statement by a gathering of all of the governments of Southern Africa that are not white, and saying, we do not wish to be understood and by anyone as saying that the white people of South Africa and Southern Africa are not Africans. They are Africans. It is racism that is un-African, and want the ability to work out a government. White people will lose a lot. The privilege of living on top and being the richest people in the world on the basis of being able to have the poorest servants in the world. So lose privilege, yes, to be part of an equal government. Black people know they need the skills of white people, but not of oppressive white people who want to stay on top. I can't also emphasize the other side enough, and that is that the longer the South African government resists, the more they ensure that their predictions will be true, that they will be driven into the sea. Let me switch and only mention, I want to mention something in passing as I switch to the spending the last moments on this implications for us. The church in South Africa, the Christians in South Africa individually and the church in general has a terrifying decision in front of it, and that is its stance on violence. That is its stance on violence in a revolution. Our own churches 200 years ago had them go through the same struggle. We didn't struggle with it very much. We just came out on the side of revolution very, very easily in our revolution. I went to Muhlenberg College, and out in front of the quadrangle is a picture of Peter Muhlenberg in him making his famous sermon, where he said with his black cassock on and without the congregation knowing it over his general's uniform, and said, "There is a time to pray and a time to fight." And he took off his robe, reached under, picked up his rifle, and marched out of the church. And there's a statue celebrating the fact that we were a people, and in many ways still are people, who are very, as a Christian church, very easily make the decision to favor violence, not only in revolution, but also to favor the violence of our government right now in making all those bombs. It's a terrifyingly difficult question for the people in South Africa to decide whether or not to the stance of Christians in violence. I mentioned yesterday in that high school I was in, where, and many, many other places, when I talked to the youth, the teenagers, the high school and university age kids of South Africa, the most important question in their mind is the resolving of the conflict between being a Christian and participating in violent revolution. In a conference I attended in Europe a month ago with South African theologians, they said this in conclusion: "We don't know where we will come out on that issue, but we do know this, that the only persons who can decide on that issue are the ones who have, first of all, decided about their stance of resistance." And so once again, expressing the need for that status confessionis, that only that decision can only be made, and it's a difficult decision to make, and there's so many implications of it, and we need to spend maybe, anybody wants to, a couple of hours just talking about that, the Christian and violence, but that the issue cannot be decided by, and that the person who opposes status confessionis cannot criticize the decision made for or against violence. It must be made from that base. Okay, in passing, I want to say a couple of things then about the United States and us as Christians. And maybe they're obvious, but I want to rehearse them about in relationship to South Africa as well as in relationship to us. That as Christians, we need to find ways to be in solidarity with the people of South Africa, especially with our Christian brothers and sisters. If this is the first time you've been exposed to the struggles in South Africa, it's not the first time the Lutheran churches in America or the Lutheran World Federation have been involved, and I strongly hope that you will use whatever information available to learn more, to teach others about, and to be in solidarity, in prayer and solidarity with that struggle in South Africa. And that's and for the first level of Christian response, that's it. To just the we are kept in ignorance about the struggles in Southern Africa. And we talked about that yesterday. And one of the reasons we're kept in ignorance is because of the conflict we have such great difficulty in facing, of the fact that our government participates in keeping South Africa alive. That government of apartheid. And so we prefer to keep silent and to keep, let's talk about the weather. So we have a responsibility to teach our brothers and sisters in our congregations at home about the issues of South Africa and their implications for us. Second of all, we really need to put pressure on our churches as institutions about this issue of disinvestment and bank withdrawal. Our churches have not progressed, and I'm giving this is not status confessionis, this is my opinion. Our churches have not progressed beyond the point of working with the companies that our churches invest in South Africa to try to make them better, less, to improve conditions in South Africa and not to get out. Our churches invest millions of dollars in corporations. Our pension funds, our endowment funds, not only the national churches, but all the church institutions, the universities, the colleges, invest monies in corporations. Many of those corporations have plants and factories and subsidiary corporations in Southern Africa. I strongly believe that our churches should at the very least disinvest from those companies. Take our money out of those companies. We can leave two shares in, because when you have a share or two, then you also have a right to speak to that country, to that company. But you don't need 1,000 shares or 5,000 shares. You only need one or two. I strongly believe that the churches should decide as a very minimum to disinvest publicly from those companies and those corporations. The ALC in its national convention in, where's it going to be, North Dakota, South Dakota, in October?
In Moorhead.
Moorhead is going to vote on that. If you know any delegate who's going there, Fran's going. If you know anybody you can teach about that issue, if you have any way of expressing your opinion, if you want to get a discussion group going next month in your congregation so that maybe the congregation can express an opinion about disinvestment, about the very minimum. It's not even taking public stand towards the government at this point. It's saying what we will do with our money, of our withdrawing our money, our disinvesting. Secondly, I think our churches should, in convention, proclaim what we believe that corporations should do, not just what we should do with our money in corporations, but what we think corporations should do. I think that instead of our churches taking the stand it now takes of trying to help corporations be more just in South Africa, I think our churches should declare that we believe it's impossible to be just in South Africa. And therefore, we stand for disinvestment, that corporations should no longer invest their money in the apartheid government. I believe that's what status confessionis means. That's not being discussed under the rubric of status confessionis in our country, because we've thought of that status confessionis decision as only applying to South Africa. I believe, and those theologians I met with in Germany 4 months ago, 4 weeks ago, believe that it also applies to any aspect of the Christian, of the Lutheran Church that is involved in matters that affect South Africa.
How would you argue, though, the companies always say usually two things. Number one, that they don't participate in the apartheid.
To invest in South Africa is to invest in apartheid. I believe
I agree with that. But they always say, well, we're not, we have, everybody gets paid the same in our company. Of course, it's like 90 cents an hour, 75 cents an hour. And the other thing is that they are really helping the people improve their lifestyle, or the typical argument that if you pulled out, then these people wouldn't have jobs, and they'd be even worse off than if they're there. And that's their two big defenses.
No, no.
And they always come back with that. Well, if we quit, then, you know, 10,000 people are going to be laid off. And I think what you're...
In general terms, that's a debate that goes throughout the world as to the ability of our... whether or not our investments really develop countries, whether or not our, and I've quite clearly said where I stand on that in terms of my belief that does not develop countries, that creates a system that requires the continuation of poverty in order that we might benefit from their resources. I believe in South Africa, although those arguments still go on, I believe they're hollower and hollower. I don't believe anybody believes them anymore. I don't even think the people who do that believe that anymore. Although, I mean, that's my personal opinion. I believe that for us, the issue of status confessionis provides another basis for us to look at that. It says, resist. Don't try and improve. Resist the system of apartheid. It says that apartheid systems cannot be improved on. That's my belief in the interpretation of status confessionis. We have to debate that. That's got to be debated in our country. Let me say a third issue. Pardon?
I wanted to say one thing. It's only been recently that American corporations' consciousness has really been awakened just in the United States in terms of ecological things and people. To go the step that you're asking for is a mighty big step that they haven't even reached in this country. How is that ever possible for them to reach it now? For a company where they just, you know, basically get profit.
I don't believe corporations will decide that. I believe corporations will continue to make their decisions on the basis of which they're constructed, maximization of profits. And I believe they'll continue to do so. I believe two things need to happen. One is that our government stop protecting them and their profits, and that's by legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, I believe that that we need to pray and work for the day when the situation in South Africa becomes so unstable that their profits are threatened.
Mm-hmm. So really it's a people conscious.
Right, right. It's a people conscious. I'm asking that the church take its stand
mm-hmm.
in relationship to corporations. The church operates on moral stands. I don't expect the corporations to, but I think the church has to speak to corporations about morality
mm-hmm.
and pray for the day when their profits won't work anymore in South Africa. And hope it comes soon. I believe at certain conditions that it's possible for a Christian to pray for bankruptcy. I have some other conditions which I think that's possible. I'll talk about them some other time, maybe. It did not come. I do not think it came up. As far as I can remember, it did not come up.
Smothered in all of the elections were problems.
Yeah.
President,
yeah.
Secretary, and
Mayor. It was heavily handled in Boston 2 years before, but it was resolved in the way of trying to influence those corporations to improve their conditions. And I don't think that was challenged in this convention.
It's interesting the way corporations responded to the Uganda situation. Some of them get the resistance in South Africa. I don't know if they parallel there, but it didn't take the coffee company
along.
I'd
be glad to talk about that. We need to stop. I'd like to say something in conclusion. The final issue of I want to push this status confessionis issue one step more. If and as I believe, at least, and I struggle with this, and I'm not always sure, but most of the time I believe that South Africa is not an issue alone, but a microcosm of the whole world. And that we have a whole set of laws that in one way or another operate so that apartheid is a system that functions in the whole world economically. Now, even if it isn't said out that way, if South Africa is a microcosm of the economic conditions of the whole world, I believe that the time that we need at least to struggle with the question about at what point for us it becomes a matter of status confessionis to resist at least those parts of our economic system that require the poverty of the rest of the world in order that we can exist. I just want to leave that with you. I don't know the answers to that. I have a lot of opinions about it. But at what point it becomes for us a matter of status confessionis, not to resist just the South African system of apartheid, but any part of any economic system that does the same thing to people as that apartheid system does, as I believe our system does on an international level. I'm willing to struggle more about that, but I just want to leave you with that question.
Okay.